Welcome to the Fret Dojo Podcast, the place where pro guitar players share their secrets. Visit www.fretdojo.com to access online courses and free resources to take your guitar playing to the next level.
Hello, it's Greg O'Rourke here from the Fret Dojo Podcast, and I'd like to welcome a very special guest and a very old friend, a blast from the past. Welcome Dan McKay, the amazing Australian classical guitarist extraordinaire. How are you going today, Dan?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks, Greg. Thanks very much for the intro.
Yeah, it's wonderful to connect again. Dan actually sent me an email recently letting me know about his brand new album, which I'd like to talk about. I'm very interested in that on today's show, Dan, but I thought it'd be a great opportunity to reconnect with you anyway. And obviously, you're a brilliant classical guitar performer, as I mentioned earlier, and you're also a very established teacher as well. So I thought this could be something a little bit different for our audience in terms of people that may be interested in looking more into classical guitar, or at least learning a little bit more about the tradition. But let's get started way back at the start. Like, what inspired you to start learning guitar? Where did it all start for you?
Well, for me, my parents are both musicians, and I did study some piano with them sort of sporadically. I'd play a little bit, and I always loved hearing them play, and but I wouldn't really practice, and it never really spoke to me, that instrument. And so I learned a lot. I learned the basics of reading music and all of that kind of stuff by doing that when I was quite young. And then had a bit of a go at guitar when I was probably about, I was definitely about sort of 7 or 8 years old. And I think at that point, I thought I was just going to pick the guitar up and sound like Kiss, you know, like I thought straight away, this is probably about 81, 82. And so I think that was my impression. And so I didn't, funnily enough, sound like that. And so the logical thing was just to stop practicing. So I did stop. And then about 5 years later, maybe a little less, I think it was... The thing that really connected with me was that it was around about when Dire Straits really went berserk, and like the Brothers in Arms album came out. I heard the single Money for Nothing, and I bought the single for my dad for Father's Day or something, and the 7-inch. And I loved that. I just thought it was great. And I thought the guitar playing, that was when I really thought, okay, so I've still got this guitar. I'm going to have a go at that. And so that sort of obviously then just, you know, you look at all the guitar heroes, you know, so my dad would have given me some Jimi Hendrix cassettes and Chuck Berry and even like Rory Gallagher and that kind of stuff. And so that was pretty much the beginning. And
But hang on a sec, because these don't sound like classical players. What's going on here? It sounds like you're interested in some other styles before you eventually transitioned into that.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, like, so... the Police and Dire Straits were sort of the first thing, and then a lot of my friends were listening to AC/DC, of course, and then through that it was all sort of like a logical progression to, you know, Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, early Metallica, and all of that kind of thing. And so I think I really just liked anything that had like a distorted electric guitar and a lead break, and the better the lead guitarist, the better the music, you know. And so a little bit after that, and so I got like just obsessed with, you know, obviously Eddie Van Halen, Randy Rhodes, Steve Vai, and around that time as well, I would have been, you know, whoever played, you know, the two guitarists in Iron Maiden, Dave Murray and Adrian Smith, that kind of thing. And they were totally my guitar education for a long time, that all of those styles. I'd sit there, I'd buy a record, and I'd just sort of try to work out all the songs, you know?
So, yeah, you were transcribing a lot of, you know, rock, metal from albums, like getting inspired by those players. What happened next? This is getting interesting.
Yeah, well, really, there's a few different things, like, because my parents are classical musicians, classically trained. They both studied at the Newcastle Conservatorium and then went on to teach and whatnot. And they... would always be listening to classical music. My dad would take me to see concerts. And so, you know, one of the earliest classical guitar concerts I would have been to would have been John Williams with Paco Peña and Inti Illimani at the Sydney Opera House, probably about 1988, I think. They'd buy me, you know, CDs and records and things of classical guitarists. But the thing that And I loved it. I did. I really loved it because, like, I could hear the technical proficiency, and the music as well did speak to me, particularly the more flamenco and then Spanish classical guitar side. I think everybody's got a piece that kind of, prompts them to get more interested in the classical guitar, or whatever it is, whatever instrument that they play. But for me, obviously, things like La Maya de Goya, by Granados, and Asturias by Albéniz, and that kind of repertoire. Hearing the difference between Segovia and John Williams play them, and hearing like that they were actually like almost two different pieces the way they were played. But the other thing as well was that I even had just some local heroes, like people who were a bit older than me, and they'd play in covers bands, and they really would only have probably been about between 17 and 20 themselves at this point, these guys. And someone said, "Oh, yeah, well, they're really great guitar players. They study classical guitar. They learn with this guy. Like, if you really want to get that level of left hand proficiency, you should go and learn classical guitar too." And so that was probably when I was about 14 or 15. And you also read about, like even say, I'd read about Randy Rhoads and people like that, and it'd talk about his love of classical guitar, and you could sort of hear, people would talk about, oh yeah, he's playing classical scales, and we all know that basically it's just, they're ripping up and down harmonic minor scales, and maybe Malmsteen's ripping off a bit of Paganini and whatever else, and developing their own style, Ritchie Blackmore, all these guys, and so I sort of thought, well, maybe there is something to look at a bit closer here. It took years though until I really dedicated to playing classical music. It was probably, I had all of these formative moments that I've mentioned, but it was probably really, I was probably like 20 years old. I'd already been studying at the Con in Sydney. I'd learned with Greg Pickler, and I'd done like, up through to my eighth grade exams and that kind of thing. And that then led me to Tim Kaine, and I met him at a summer school in Sydney and listened to like Tim's album with John Williams that he'd done, The Mantis and the Moon. They were touring quite a lot at that time. So yeah, I was sort of quite old already by the time I'd really gone, okay, I'm going to play classical guitar, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
You know, it's an interesting connection we have there, Dan, because I too studied with Tim Kaine, the amazing classical guitar performer and teacher based in Canberra there. And you know, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but do you know what it actually inspired me to go and study in Canberra? It was actually, I think it was yourself and Stephen Poskett playing at one of those competitions in Sydney, and I started to see these amazing classical players one after the other come up and play, and they all had very distinctive guitars. You know, you guys were using those kind of carbon fiber soundboard guitars, and I went, you know, I've got to go study with whoever these guys are studying with. So there you go.
And I had that same reaction too when I first went to Darwin, I think, and I saw, Steve and Alex and Luke Tierney, and I'd already been aware of Peter Constant and Carolyn Kidd and Mark Norton and the previous, sort of generation, I suppose, that had gone through Tim, and I was just like, yeah, there's something in the water. And I had the same reaction. So it is funny that the thing that can inspire you sometimes might not be the people on the big stage, but sort of more of the almost like people just it can be more or less just like yourself. That's what I found.
No, it's amazing, amazing, amazing how things turn out. That kind of your winding path all the way from Dire Straits to pretty cutting edge classical guitar music. But now I want to talk about your new album, the interestingly titled "Suffering and Madness."
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds like some pretty easy listening there, Dan. So do you want to tell us a little bit about, in a nutshell, what this new album's all about?
Yeah, well, it's mostly modern Australian music. It's mostly things, the repertoire on there is all written this century, apart from one piece by Leo Brower. A lot of the music has a little bit of I don't want to say dark, because that can kind of, give you different connotations. It's all very melodic, but it has a variety of moods. And so the title, Suffering and Madness, even though it doesn't sound that typical for classical guitar
Sounds more
CD.
like sounds more
It's
like a metal album cover, man.
yeah, that's right. I know. And that's kind of part of the appeal for me as well, is that I like things that don't just have one connotation, I suppose, or that maybe a little bit not cliched, but things that sort of maybe stray a little bit from the norm, I guess. But it is actually one of the titles of a track that Philip Houghton wrote on there. There's a suite
Okay.
called Ophelia, which is subtitled A Haunted Sonata, and one of the titles of the tracks is of the movements is Suffering and Madness. So when I sort of was looking for a title, it's fairly typical. Sometimes you might title a CD by one of the names of the pieces, and I thought, well, that's different. I've got a copy here, and
Okay.
so my daughter actually did the artwork. So even the artwork that my daughter did was sort of like a little bit of an anime style and a little bit subdued and shadowy, and so yeah, it's all a little bit different,
Yeah, it's
but the style
interesting
works.
you say that most of, like nearly all of them, with the exception of one piece, was written in this century,
Yeah.
the 21st century. So,
Yeah,
kind
that's
of,
right.
was your intent here to sort of showcase the amazing music that's being written by living composers? Was that kind of what motivated you? Like, what was your intent in putting this project together?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no to that question. The thing was that I recorded it at home in this room. During we had this sort of like brief period of time that maybe slipped under the mainstream media where during 2020 and 2021 you couldn't go out a lot. I don't know if that sort of news made
Vaguely rings a bell, I think.
it. And so I was sort of really getting like probably a lot of musicians a little bit down about things in a way. A lot of things were great, a lot more time with your family and a lot of time to do some things that you enjoy doing, but couldn't rehearse with my quartet, couldn't rehearse with my guitar duo, gigs were being cancelled. And so at one point I sort of realized, look, we had a curfew here in Melbourne, and so there was no traffic after about 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
There was no noise, nothing flying overhead, nothing. So I thought, well, I've got these, like, I've got some reasonable quality recording gear. I've got some decent microphones. I bought some Octava Mark 12s at the suggestion of an engineer friend of mine. And I thought, I'm going to have a go while it's quiet of recording a CD at home. And I learned how to use Reaper, the
Oh, yeah.
recording software. So I was using some other things, but a friend of mine said, you should really give this a go. It's cheap, it's really powerful. A lot of studios are using it as their main digital audio workstation. And so because I had time, I thought, all right, I'll have a go at that. And so then obviously there's the technology and there's learning to use the software and mic placement and all these things, but then you need music to record. And
Yeah,
so
that's right.
basically, yeah, what I was thinking is like, well, I can sort of, just sort of sit here like this for ages and try to put together like a program that really fits together, or I can record things that are sort of at arm's reach. In a way, I was like, well, look, I can practice all day and then I can record after 8 o'clock at night, and I can record until whenever, didn't have to get up too early because there was nowhere to go. And so I thought that's what I'll do. And so in a way, it sort of the program just fell together because of the things that I had at arm's reach. And on the one hand, if I'd have really sat and thought about it, well, for one thing, I may never have finished it. If I had sat and thought about it, I might have changed some things around a little bit. But when I listen to it, I think, no, that all works. Those pieces work together. Hika, as you know, is a memoriam piece, like for Toru Takemitsu. And then some of the other pieces have that little bit of melancholy about them, and so even though it's not all Australian or it's not all contemporary American or South American or whatever, it all sort of fits together in that way, I think. Yeah.
Just a quick note as a side note, also with what you mentioned about Reaper, that is a fantastic piece of software. I've used that myself quite a bit for
Yeah.
my own recordings, both video and audio, and using that in the mix. And what's amazing about this software, guys, is that you can use it for a 14-day trial, but I think perpetually. So or there's something like that in the
That's right.
on the interface where you can just keep saying I'm still evaluating, and you never need
Yeah.
to pay for this software.
That's
I hope they
right.
don't mind me saying that, but that seems to be one of the options there. So for those of you guys out there interested in getting into some home recording, as Dan says, incredibly powerful piece of software at pretty much zero cost. So all you need is
Yes,
a
that's
couple of
right.
microphones and an audio interface, and you're good to go. But I'd love to actually play a track off this brand new album, Dan. So what's the track that we're going to listen to now?
Yeah, well, this piece is by Robert Davidson. He's a Brisbane-based composer, and he's one of my favorite composers. He's got a terrific ensemble called Topology that he's written a lot of music for. He's written quite a bit of guitar music over the years, including pieces for the quartet that Tim Kaine leads. I used to play for Guitar Trek, and my own quartet, the Melbourne Guitar Quartet, he's written music for us. But this piece, Cliffside, he wrote for me, well, my parents commissioned it for my birthday a few years ago, and it was a complete surprise to me. They didn't know that he was one of my favourite composers. I'm not exactly sure how they stumbled onto commissioning a piece from Robert, but it's one of my favourite little guitar pieces. It's a little bit of a, it's a sort of a miniature, but it's quite evocative, I think, and it's a beautiful piece, and I'm so glad that that they commissioned it for me for my birthday.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful piece of music. And for those of you guys listening to this podcast, I'd like you to really pay attention to the interesting lines that are often present in classical guitar music. Like classical guitar is quite amazing because it's almost like you're playing several instruments at once, rather than just playing like a single line, like say Pat Martino would do when playing a solo. It's more like you can hear this interesting polyphony where you can hear the bass lines, some inner moving lines, and a really skilled classical player like Dan can kind of bring out certain lines to emphasize moments or different parts in the music, and it makes it a very rich listening experience. So this is Cliffside, played by Dan McKay and composed by Robert Davidson from Dan's new album, Suffering and Madness. Let's check it out.
Thank you.
Okay, so how wonderful was that? That was Cliffside, played by Dan McKay, who's on today's show with me, and that was composed by the fabulous Robert Davidson. What I would like to do in this part of the podcast is to talk a little bit about tips for students, you know, people that are trying to learn the guitar, regardless of skill. Maybe there's some classical players listening to this show right now, but regardless of what style of guitar you play, you know, something that I really wanted to pick your brains about is how to teach and best teaching practice, because you're one of the most established classical guitar teachers in Australia. So let's kick off with a few questions here. You know, what do you think are the most important things guitar students should focus on in their practice session?
I think the first thing, and I think that I try to encourage this at pretty much every level, is, you know, every practice session, I think you should be trying to go in with a focus and trying to go in with something that you want to achieve. I think that, you know, there is something to be said, and is really important as well, for, you know, doing the reps and getting the time in and you know, just time on the instrument. But I think that even when you only have short periods of time to practice, if you sort of think to yourself, okay, this session, what I have to do, I have to learn these scales, and I'm just going to get that C sharp melodic minor scale. You know, I'm going to spend 10 minutes on that. If you spend a short period of time on something, you know, you can really achieve something. You know, if you spend like, if you sort of think, well, I've got this amount of time, I'm just going to touch everything, and you don't really think about what you sort of want to do, I think that that can be not the best way to spend the time. Mm. So I try to think that like that way myself when I'm practicing. I try to think, okay, you know, sometimes you just want to pick up and play and no worries. But I do try to think when I'm practicing and I'm really practicing, I sort of think about what it is that I'm trying to do this session. And that could just be one phrase that I want to kind of, I hesitate to say perfect, because, you know, like that's, you know, there's always a little bit more you might like to do, but, you know, but make progress on, you know, and have some sense of achievement, you know, at the end of that session.
That laser focus is so important, isn't it? And it can be quite challenging to have the discipline to kind of put other things aside for the sake of improving just one core aspect. But it really is the path that pretty much every pro player has walked to success, is that having that laser focus. And in terms of, let's go all the way back, because I know you've taught people from all levels, right? From beginner all the way to you know, exceptional classical players. But if, say, someone was starting from scratch, what do you think would be the logical progression of exercises or fretboard knowledge? You know, what do you think they should really establish as the foundations first?
Yeah, well, from scratch, like with the classical guitar, the way that I like to teach is I like to teach, obviously, as you know, when you're learning classical guitar, music reading and technical kind of development, they sort of go hand in hand for a bit. And so I try to get them to the point where they're not just playing, you know, notes, but they're playing some tunes. Because I feel that that's one thing that we respond to. We respond to melody. If you feel like you're already doing something, like you would know yourself, like when you first pick up a guitar, and even if it is just, you know, playing a riff, like, you know, when you, and you go, wow, that sounds like something. They'll recognize that. And there's a lot of, you know, simple melodies, and it's not, you know, sitting there and saying, now listen here, Johnny, that's a crotchet, and, you know, all this kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of those principles you mentioned are very Pan style as well. You know, when you were talking about, you know, have sort of a melody for your ears to hang on to, because, you know, that trains your ears, it connects your ears to the fretboard. Like the great jazz guitarist Barney Kessel, he actually has a few videos on YouTube you can find where he talks about that very concept, you know, one of his first lessons. Actually figure out a tune from ear and see if you can hit it on the guitar. You know, like I think regardless of whether you play jazz or classical or anything else, you know, those kind of fundamental ear training skills, it gives you a lot of more security when you're playing the guitar, because you can start to be guided by what your mind wants to play rather than just kind of mechanical patterns. So no, really good advice there, Dan. So in terms of this is a kind of a tangent question, but something I often get asked about like as a jazz player, like I guess I play a few styles. Obviously, as you know, I've studied classical for a long time, but into jazz now. People are quite impressed by my fingerstyle skills when it comes to playing like jazz standards and chord melodies and things like that. Now, I kind of just take it for granted, but how have you found to really help people develop fingerstyle technique in particular? It's just a question I've been asked so much, I thought it'd be good to pick your brains on as well.
Well, do you know, it's funny because like if you go through like the basic classical methodology and whatever, then there's clear sort of, you know, progression, lineage, whatever. You know, you sort of learn a few simple kind of dances where you might use your thumb and these two fingers and you're arpeggiating and playing free stroke and all that kind of stuff. But I've had to think about it a lot more recently because I have a student who sort of hit me up. I sort of knew him in passing. He plays in a band that I love. You know, he plays the bass and sings, and he does a lot of other solo things as well. But he said, look, I do all of my writing on a classical guitar, but I have no technique, you know.
Okay.
I can't read music. He said, like, you know, as soon as I get to something, I just work out a different way of doing it. And I said, okay. And he said he saw some videos that I'd been putting up, and we had, like I said, we knew each other in passing. And he asked, would I be open to teaching him? And so it was funny because I had to think about that in a, like I was saying, if you're teaching classical guitar from the beginning, there's a progression, and you, hey, well, you start here. And you, but if someone can play, but they want to learn a bit more about this, it's very difficult for me to go back and say, okay, we're going to start with, you know, I don't know, Shearer book one or whatever it is. And, you know, because they're already, their harmonic and melodic awareness and their compositional skills and whatever is far in advance of that. And so I don't really want to do that. So I sort of ended up teaching this student. I still end up using Giuliani and things like that. Yeah. I said, look, you can use any chords that you like. I taught him the names of the fingers. I showed him more or less, I said, look, this is the finger pattern. And then within that, there's a bit of music reading tuition going on as well. And that's been really, really great, you know, because straight away a few little patterns that he could sort of pick out and then apply to his own compositional skills. And I thought, hey, that's you know, Giuliani and all that sort of stuff, that's for everybody. That's really good.
The Giuliani studies, just for you guys that are not sure what those are, there are 120 exercises, and would you believe they're all based on a C and G7 chord. Over and over again, it goes C, G7, C, G7. One of the technique books I read once on classical was like, these exercises are great, but that harmony is cruel and unusual punishment. So
that's right.
I like your tip of kind of mixing it up to different chords if possible, just to kind of make them a bit more interesting, you know.
I even grab that C chord and take it up to the, like, say, so your third finger's holding the G on the fifth string, you know.
Oh, nice,
You know, and then you play that and you get this kind of, like, this G chord, but, you know, with this sort of, like, you know, the voicing is just, well, not quite a G chord because the E is in there, but, like, this nice voicing and everything. But we did 120. We did them every year, remember, as part of the degree, and had to do all 120. You know?
Yeah, it was kind of like being like the Shaolin monks or something of classical guitar. you just have to do these like hours and hours. I remember one day I was completely obsessed with those things. I'd spend like 6 hours a day in a practice room working on those exercises just to get my technique down. So, but you guys have to do that. Don't freak out. I think the message here is you got to really, if you're going to develop fingerstyle technique, it's not like the exercises need to be amazingly kind of innovative or complex, but you do need to do daily application and stay very focused, maintaining that discipline to develop your muscles and connections to your brain and all that sort of thing. It comes over time after that consistent application. So that's a bit about fingerstyle now, but let's talk about some of the biggest mistakes and myths when it comes to playing guitar. Where do you think people consistently go wrong or things that are critical ingredients that they're missing out on?
Yeah, critical ingredients for me in my own sort of personal philosophy, I suppose. The first critical ingredient, I think, is you've got to do it a lot. you have to practice, you know, you have to play. You know, I talk to young students sometimes and their parents, and I say, listen, when your teacher says I want you to practice for this long a day or whatever, or I want you to practice every day, all you're being asked to do is play the guitar. And the fact that your parents have stumped up or whatever, or you're stumping up the money, implies that you enjoy playing the guitar. So all you're being asked to do is play the guitar. That's what practice is. And so I think that, like, the time on the instrument, I think that is really important. I think that, you know, sometimes I've had, like, tertiary students, they'll say to me things like, you know, and they'll be quite young, you know, like maybe first, second year, and they'll say something like, well, just as long as it's good practice, it doesn't really matter, you know, how much you do. And I just straight up say, you know, I disrespectfully do not agree. Not respectfully agree, disagree, sorry. But like, I don't agree. I think that, you know, especially at that age, I think that who is the person who can sort of decide, you know, what good practice is anyway, and particularly at that kind of an age, you know, there's like some of these judgments that people might make about, your parenting. Are you a good parent? When does that judgment get made? You know, like, you know, is it made, you know, because you, I don't know, when is it made? How's it made? Who makes it, you know? And so with what is good practice, I think that it's important to think about things like posture and taking breaks and your physical durability and all that kind of stuff, of course. And so if you're just sitting there, you know, bent over a music stand for 6 to 8 hours or whatever, and you're not making any, doing any other physical movement or whatever, okay, fair enough. That's bad practice. You know, that's because it's bad for you, you know. Might be good for this in some ways, but it's not good for expression and it's not good for your physical well-being in any other way. But sort of say, you know, that you only need to do this much of good practice, you know, then I think I'm not too convinced with that. With the qualifier that, yes, if you do sort of have a, you know, brief moments of time and you can focus on specific things and you can do that, like I was talking about before, yes, of course, that's really important. But I do think hours on the instrument, you would know yourself and you still would see it. But, you know, when we were studying, you could sometimes see that someone was just so comfortable on the instrument. They were holding that instrument. They had that all the time, you know. And I can think of certain players in our department in particular. I'm not saying that they were necessarily like the best players or that they were better than others or others weren't as good, but that level of comfort, you know, that's important, you know, I think. And that often comes from, you know, reps, you know, from doing it.
As Arnold Schwarzenegger says, you got to do those reps.
The reps.
I find the thing about the practice, like, sometimes practice goes well, sometimes it doesn't go so well, sometimes you get a breakthrough, sometimes you don't. But it's a bit like dollar cost averaging, if people familiar with, like, that investing concept. Is like, no matter what the season of the day or what the market's doing, you just invest the same amount each day, and that's what gets you the long-term returns, rather than I don't really feel like it today, maybe I don't need to practice or whatever. I think if you really want to improve your music skills, get on your guitar, you know, daily application if you can, even if it's very short. That's really where the consistency is key, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, just doing something every day, picking the guitar up, you know, playing. Even if you think, oh, well, I've only got 5 minutes, not worth it. Well, guess what? That 5 minutes might turn into 15 or 20 minutes, you know. But also that 5 minutes might be worth it if you sort of have that focus. You know, another thing that I think is probably just as important, it goes on almost all of the reports that I write whenever I have to write a report for somebody for uni or for high school or whatever it is you know, listening to the repertoire, you know, studying the repertoire, even beyond, you know, you would know that you would have students sometimes, and really the only pieces that they might know for their instrument are the pieces that they've played. And to sort of get out of that, like, you know, and that might be studying other works by those composers that they're playing, or those jazz guitar players that they're playing, or whatever it is. Or it might be, you know, you listen to an album of your favorite guitarist and you just go and look up the other composers that are on that album, you know, and you go and listen to other repertoire, and that leads you into new things. I think that's also something that gets, you know, the study of the instrument. It's not just, you know, on the instrument, it's everything around it, you know, and the repertoire that's out there, you know, like that's how I sort of anyway kind of developed a love for the instrument, I think.
Yeah, really swimming in the ocean of music, you know, like it can expand your mind. I remember the great classical virtuoso Augustin Barros Mangor. He said something like, for one to excel in music, you must be bathed in the fountain of culture. You know, so you've really got to kind of expand your mind, you know, like, so, and like, this is particularly important for jazz as well, so you don't get too locked in. Like, often jazz guitar students, for example, they just listen to jazz guitar recordings. They don't listen to other instruments, and some of the best jazz is not on guitar. It's on other instruments, like Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, and so forth. But likewise for classical guys, you know, like just don't listen just to classical guitar. Listen to a whole bunch of different classical music, because it can give you some really interesting ideas. Coming back to classical guitar, Dan, like, this is a question I have for you. Why do you love classical guitar? Why has this kind of become the passion and focus of your career and your musical life?
That's a really good question. And part of it, you know, I have to go back to think about it, because over time, you know, it becomes something different, doesn't it? You know, when you're doing something professionally and you're doing it your whole life, and sometimes you have to, you know, stop and think, what is it? You know, sometimes you find yourself just practicing because you've got different obligations, things to do. And lately I've been able to just pick up the guitar and play different pieces and things and make little clips for friends and whatever, just because I enjoy it. Just because, you know, it's that time of the year and everything. But I think that one thing I really loved about it to begin with, and I still love, is that you can play it on your own. And like you said earlier on, when you're listening to the piece Cliffside, you know, you're playing all these lines, you know, you're a band in a box, you know, or I think Leo Brower said, like, the orchestra within six strings, you know, like, you know, and I think that that's what I really like about it. You can play, you know, something so simple and it sounds nice. You know, you can play, like, even, you know, a kid can pick it up and make a nice sound and everything, you know. Other instruments, drums or wind instruments, you know, other bowed instruments, maybe not quite the same, you know, like, so that's one thing about it. But for me personally, I just loved that you could just pick it up and play the whole thing. I got really disenchanted with playing music where I had to be with other people all the time. I mean, I'm social and I like that aspect of it, but, you know, it's not the same if you're just playing your part by yourself, you know, and you, you know, you need other people to fit in. And then I really think that going through that period in the 90s where there was that real sort of golden patch of, you know, guitar construction, composition and performance, you know, not to look back and say things were, you know, a certain way or whatever, but there was definitely a historical thing that happened in Australia at that time, you know, with, like, you know, guitar makers like Greg Smallman, Eugene Philp, you know, even Simon Marty and all these other guys really rising to the top of the world stage for the construction and everything, being really recognized for what they were doing. Phil Houghton, Nigel Westlake, Ross Edwards, Richard Charlton, these kinds of composers writing for the guitar. These kinds of people that I would see play and hear them play and just go, yeah, that's what I want to do. Like, I felt like it was really great to be around that. But for me, you know, look, even just picking up my Smallman and just playing the E string, and just, that's a good sound, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's a great sound. You know, yeah. So I still just like the sound you can make on the guitar. It's a versatile instrument. You know, I played a piece for guitar and electronics a little while ago. There's a clip on YouTube. It's called Bleed Through by Sam Smith, who you might have met in Canberra.
Yeah, I think just as I was wrapping up my studies, Sam was there, I think. Yeah, I remember Sam. Yeah, lovely guy.
It's one of my favourite modern pieces for the classical guitar, but it's guitar and laptop, you know, and like all these electronics and stuff. And so, you know, one of the pieces on my CD is the Hinchinbrook Riffs by Nigel Westlake for guitar and digital delay. Mm-hmm, I mean, you know, it's so versatile. You can do anything. You can carry it around, you know. When kids say, oh, I couldn't practice because we went away, it's like, dude, I go away, I take three guitars, you know. I've got my guitar, my kids bring a guitar, and then my son brings an electric guitar. You know, there's like, you know, that's the whole idea. It's not a grand piano, you know. It's a portable instrument.
Totally.
You know, take it camping. I don't take my Smallman camping, but, you know, got like...
they're wafer thin, those tops of those guitars. You got to be careful with them, don't you?
I don't think I'll take that one to camping, but you know, keep one that I can take, and it's great. You sit around. It's not so much, drumming by the campfire, but I just sit there sometimes and I'll play under a tree, get away from people for a bit, just sit there, have a bit of play. Or sometimes I actually have to practice when I'm away. Like, it's like I've got a concert a week later, it's just like, well, don't really have the luxury of just having a week off, So actually have to practice this program. But anyway, yeah, but that's all of those things. That's a pretty rambling answer. I hope it sort of gets to some of the heart of why I love it, but
Oh no, totally,
yeah.
man. Yeah, no, but I remember being in that scene that that Sydney guitar scene and getting just so inspired. I remember as a kid just going like every day after school I would practice for a couple of hours, like late into the night. I was completely obsessed with classical guitar. But I think before I went to the dark side, I've gone to jazz now. But I find that those skills that I got from classical has made me the player I am. Like because if you really have a command of the instrument, then you can do whatever you want on it. And
Yes.
what I love about classical is that systematized approach to building technique, which is, I believe, is a little bit more absent in other styles, perhaps. And people might be struggling, worrying, oh, I can't, I'm struggling to improvise or I'm struggling to comp on in jazz, for example. But the real reason is they just haven't built their chops enough, and the great thing about classical is that those you have it all there once you've studied classical. So Dan, it's been absolutely fabulous to have you on the show today. Look, where can people find you, and if they're interested in buying your album, Suffering and Madness, well, where should they go to for that?
You can go straight to my website, which is just danmckay.net. It's just my name. And everything's information, contact details, and album purchase, and also links. You just still just stream the CD, like stream the album. It's on all the major streaming providers now. So there's links for all of that there, plus all the other albums that I've made over the last 20 years, I guess. Solo albums and things with duos and Guitar Trek and whatnot, and the Melbourne Guitar Quartet. And I have an Instagram account too that might be of interest to some people.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Dan. So make sure you look Dan up on those links. We'll put them in the show notes for this podcast, either on YouTube or wherever you're listening to it, if you're listening to the audio. And yeah, Dan, well, it's been wonderful to connect with you again, man. It's been many years. And yeah, I've really
It's been
enjoyed our chat today. And you've provided tremendous value for all students of guitar, regardless of style. I think you guys should pay close attention to what Dan was saying, especially about the nuances of practicing and focusing, and the how you should approach improving your skills on guitar, because there were some amazing nuggets there. So thank you so much, the fabulous Dan McKay.
Thanks, Greg. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, mate.
So that was the classical guitar guru, Dan McKay. Make sure that you check him out at his website and on his Instagram. The links are in the show notes. Make sure you give this show a 5-star review if you're listening to it on iTunes, or otherwise like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. It'd be fantastic to have you back again for another episode. We've got some wonderful guitarists lined up and some more lessons as well. So this is Greg O'Rourke from the Fret Dojo podcast, and we'll see you in the next one. And for more jazz guitar lessons, tips, and free stuff, visit www.fretdojo.com.